This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Real life is scarier than anything we can dream of,
and we dream such frightening things.
Sci-fi and Squeam, be afraid.
Be very afraid.
On Joy 94.9.
Welcome to Sci-fi and Squeam. I'm Sonia, and Kaz is here.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to Dystopic Visions. That's our topic for tonight. And we've got Albert here on the panel as well.
Thanks, Albert.
Thank you, Albert. Okay, and thanks to Steve for his Spice Girls trip
that
around the world.
That was exciting.
It was exciting for some here, definitely. Yes, I saw the movie once. That was good enough.
They did quite a dystopic film clip for Spice Up Your Life.
Right. Okay.
A lot of black leather and PVC, I think.
Oh, cool. Okay, so tonight we're going to be looking at our show on Sci-Fi and Squeam here. We're looking at movie comparisons, for example, Blade Runner versus Children of Men. We'll also be looking at books, literature, Michel Houellebecq and Neuromancer from William Gibson. Just looking at some of the similarities and differences. Films like Time of the Wolf and Blindness. And Kaz, you've got something too there that you're going to
into. I'm going to talk about everybody's favourite kind of album, the concept album.
Ooh.
So I can hear people turning off already. Don't do
no,
it.
You
just
don't
wait.
Need to.
It's not
I
that
was
bad.
Around then, so that's cool. And speaking of a concept album, the track we just heard was from an album called In the Future, and that was by a Canadian group called Black Mountain, and that was Tyrants, and they're from Vancouver, and quite a classic. And that whole album is actually quite conceptual. The theme is about environmental degradation and ecocide, and also about loss of friends and political corruption in Canada. So, and that came out in 2008. So it's not just something that belongs to the 70s.
No
concept idea.
And all the concept albums I'm going to look at tonight have come around in the last decade or so. So it's quite recent. And it just looks at a few of the things that can happen in the future. So we're going to start off by looking at a couple of films based on novels that look at the future of humanity and where things might go horribly wrong. We're going to look at Blade Runner and Children of Men. Blade Runner came out in 1982, and the film itself has been viewed through almost every intellectual and cultural framework that's out there. It's been dissected by feminists, environmentalists, Marxists, scientists. It's
people
set
with ists on the end.
People with ists at the end, mm. and letters and degrees. Set in the year 2019.
That's not far away, actually.
It's not too far away, and this is the thing about living in... Well, we're in 2010 now, and all of these future settings are coming up. In the world of Blade Runner, the wealthy live in palaces that reach to the sky, and the working classes toil below. There are also genetically engineered beings called replicants, and they tend to work as slaves off-world. In Blade Runner, a group of them have escaped and returned to Earth. Now, they were designed to have a 4-year lifespan, which was something their creator put in as a safety mechanism, in case they started getting ideas, and a few of them have, and they've landed on Earth determined to find a way around that. Now, most people are familiar with the film Blade Runner.
And the different versions. Like, how many are there?
I think there are two kind of main versions. There's sort of the theatrical cut and the director's cut, and that is crucial because the debate continues to this very day over whether that character, Rick Deckard, is a replicant or not. And some people argue heatedly that he is, and some people...
I know someone, I've got a friend who unfortunately would have been excellent for the show, but he's been on leave. He won't even comment on that.
He won't comment?
I said, but the
guys... Does he know something we don't know?
The guys are, you know, a robot, basically, and he just gets very protective.
Well, that's the thing, and I think that with Blade Runner, it doesn't really matter whether he is or not in the end, because he's kind of at the beginning at least, he's lost a sense of what it is to be a human being. And as the film unfolds, you start to question yourself what humans have become in this world. Eldon Tyrrell, who's the creator of the replicants, he's aging and he's cut himself off from fellow human beings and kind of taken on the role of a god. And he sees these replicants as brilliant products of design and thinks that, you know, they should pretty much be happy enough, as he says, to burn twice as bright, even if they only burn half as long. Tyrrell is obscene in his testing of replicants. He creates an assistant, Rachel, and plants false memories in her mind. So she thinks she's human, but she's in fact a replicant. But it doesn't stop her from feeling and loving and hurting just as much as any human being does. Now, in the film, they test humanity by something called the Voight-Kampff test. And this is supposed to be something that tests a subject's empathy. But it's sort of interesting because if you put the person who created the replicants in the chair for the Voight-Kampff test...
It sounds very German. Where is that from?
I'm not sure, to be honest.
A Nazi German
thing? They just kind of... It could be related to it. I mean, they ask questions, it sets scenarios in place and sort of test how empathic you are. And replicants are supposed to have less empathy and human beings are supposed to have more.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a really great human character in the film called J.F. Sebastian, who's played by the wonderful William Sanderson. And he's a very introverted, lonely genius. He's very compassionate, but he's a little too docile. And he empathises with the replicants because he himself suffers from a disease.
Yeah, progeria. He comes across quite as a gross sort of... weakling, actually.
He does,
film, doesn't he? Pathetic creature, really.
Exactly. And you kind of pity him, yeah. But he kind of, you know, has that sort of repulsion at the same time. But he, obviously, he empathises with the replicants because he has a shorter lifespan because of this disease that he suffers from. Look, in the world of Blade Runner, life is cheap and animals can be synthesised and grown and sold on a market. And maybe it is only the replicants and the people like J.F. Sebastian who actually take time to explore the decent side of being human, much as you would argue that the replicants take on a very violent role in the film. What they're searching for is meaning and they want more time.
Well, like Malcolm X said, by any means possible. And if you have to use violence, I mean, you will.
That's it. And they're fighting.
Political violence.
They're fighting
too.
For their existence and their freedom. And they don't just see themselves as carbon copies. They develop their own personalities. So these characters, they earn their humanity. It's not just given to them.
It's a big question that comes up again and again with, probably in the future you'll find, with the whole cloning debate, actually.
Absolutely. It's something that was also, it's been brought up in many things and many sort of TV shows now are looking at clones and their place. With Blade Runner, you've got clones, but they're these idealized, sort of they're beautiful, they're strong, they're vital.
They're Daryl Hannah.
They're Rutger Hauer at his peak. And Rutger Hauer plays Roy Batty, who's the leader of the escaped replicants. And it's look, there's arguably one of the best scenes of his career and of sci-fi films.
It is
full stop when he's on the rooftop in the rain and he says, "I've seen things you people wouldn't believe, attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I've watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time like tears in rain, time to die."
That's on the soundtrack, actually.
And it's a beautiful, beautiful piece. You know, and just every time it gets me, because the film is making a point emphatically that whether you're a human or a replicant, experiencing life and not just surviving it is
imperative.
Isn't
he holding a bird?
He's holding a white dove.
When he's dying, yes.
Yeah, he's holding a dove and he releases
it. Jesus Christ.
It is a little bit. And then I think they do a slow shot panning when the dove flies away and it's a beautiful shot. And there's the character of Gaff who sort of says, you know, it's too bad she won't live. But then again, who does? So it's really about experiencing life. That was Blade Runner. We're going to look at Children of Men after these messages. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam with Sonia and Kaz, and we're talking about dystopian visions or dystopic visions.
Oh, well, do we need the definitions?
Might be good to go over that. So at the moment we're comparing Blade Runner and Children of Men, but it's good to get an idea of what dystopia, and I suppose as well what utopia, are defined as. So utopia comes is essentially accepted as coming from Thomas More's book, which was called Utopia. There was a longer Latin title, which I won't read out here. And it was around the 16th century that Moore wrote this book about sort of this ideal society that was based on great equality and harmony, prosperity and stability. So dystopia is kind of the opposite of that.
I guess where it's described as a place or a state where everything is actually breaking down, pessimism, lack of optimism, corruption in the state system, infrastructure perhaps collapsing. Usually, yeah, some sort of calamity is involved first, and then the unravelling begins of society in general. I think that's what most people think, you know, dystopia or dystopic situation does occur, in which conditions are very bad and often oppression and terror usually follows.
That's right. And I think a lot of authors and artists who sort of describe their own dystopia, they're not acting – you never get the impression that it's a utopian society for anybody, even those who are in control. There's always that element of instability, like you said, where the system could break down at any point.
And what happens when that does occur?
Exactly, the consequences of that decay. We were just talking about Blade Runner and the way that Ridley Scott film shows society in the future in the year 2019, which is not too far away. Children of Men was a film that came out in 2006, and it's probably a much grittier look at the future of human beings. The world's a familiar one. It's the UK in the year 2027 or 2027, for people who don't like that American pronunciation, a world which is 8 years older than the one in Blade Runner, but is far closer to, I think, where we'll be when the time comes.
Seems more realistic.
Seems more realistic, for sure. The premise of the film is that there have been two decades of human infertility around the world, and the end of humanity is very, very near. Society's collapsing, terrorists are fighting to the grim end, and the environment is bearing the brunt of all of this. The UK battles with incoming immigrants who are seeking safety but finding only persecution. One of the refugees is a woman named Key, and she's pregnant.
Key.
She's the key to, yes, is pregnant. She could be carrying sort of the human species' last hope. Clive Owen, who is wonderful in this, plays Theo Farren, who's charged with caring for Key and finding her safe passage to a group of scientists who are working on something called the Human Project. Now, the director of Children of Men, Alfonso Cuarón, apparently told his art department that this film was the anti-Blade Runner.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So he acknowledged that there was going to be comparisons made. And essentially what his sort of message to the film department was that they were going to reject a stylized sci-fi kind of look for the world. And you can see that.
It looks like Iraq or, you know, Beirut or...
That's it. It's got a very contemporary...
Sarajevo, you know, in the 90s.
Well, exactly.
Or Northern Ireland, actually.
Anything. You've got scenes of refugees and they're in cages and they're in camps. They're being rounded up by the military. So it is, like you said, it's reminiscent of those images, or even reminiscent of the detainees in Camp X-Ray in Guantanamo Bay or Abu Ghraib. But also something that strikes you when you're watching it is almost that sort of the feel of the Holocaust. They've got that... a lot of images that sort of are reminiscent of photos from that period.
And don't they show that at the beginning of the film? Because of the lack of fertility, what's happening is there are no children. So also you've got a workforce that is getting older. I mean, our workforce now apparently is getting older. So if this is the scenario, there won't be anybody functioning.
There's no one functioning.
No children.
No children running around. It's a very grim...
And don't they have some really gritty kind of realistic documentary style? Because it's all handheld camera, which is also great. I don't think they liked it in the movie show, but I love the handheld cameras. Gives you that sort of intimacy. And
it really did. And it was the kind of great handheld camera work that didn't make you feel sick. It made you feel...
Wasn't
like
a dogma
you
film.
Were there. No, it made you feel like you were dropped right in the middle of it. And that's what this film does. It brings this situation so much closer to our time, and it's got a certain urgency to it, and it makes it feel like it's taking place right here and right now instead of in the future. Like Blade Runner, Children of Men is based on a novel by P.D. James, who is actually more famous for her crime novels.
Yeah, she's fantastic. I used to read those when I was younger.
She's very prolific.
And she's great.
Been writing for years. And she actually said, she's quoted as saying, she wrote the book in answer to the question, if there were no future, how would we behave? And I mean, if you look at Children of Men, if that's anything to go by, then we continue sort of to fail to treasure whatever life we've got left.
Look how we behave now with our infrastructure, which is working in democracies like the ones we have. Our infrastructure's working, unlike a minority of places still.
That's it.
It's working. So imagine if we were the majority living like, you know, some places now in the world. It would be pretty frightening.
That's it. We don't really scrabble, sort of, you know, most people in Australia don't scrabble to make a living.
Exactly.
So, but look, Blade Runner was set in 2019 in a world that bears a passing resemblance to our own, and Children of Men is our world. I mean, it's only about 17 or so years into the future now. It's a decayed world, but it's totally recognisable. While I've always seen in Blade Runner a hope for technology and scientific advancement. So, you know, you can create replicants, you can create animals.
It was made in 1982.
That's right.
And this is pre-2 stock market crashes and pre-3 recessions.
So it may have been
Have changed quite dramatically.
That's it.
Just so economically, globally.
I think Children of Men takes it a step further and really expresses the bleakness of a world where humans have just failed to be really decent
to one another.
And that director,
he's from, he's from a Latin American country, so he probably had
exposure. I think he might
exposure,
be from Mexico, yeah.
Yeah, exposure to certain, you know, infrastructures that when they don't go right. And Ridley Scott is from, you know,
the UK.
The UK, and from a fairly good background as far as I'm aware.
So it's one of those things where it's fair enough to say sort of that Cuarón has made a film that's quite bleak, but I think he wants to leave viewers with a germ of hope that, you know, Key and her baby might survive and that the geneticists and the doctors could learn enough to save humanity. But I think, again, when you're watching it and when you're reading anything about positing the future as such a place, is it worth it? And what are we bringing humanity back for? If, you know, this small band of brilliant scientists in Children of Men can break the code and they can bring humans back from the brink, they're just going to be fighting against the majority who pushed to get them there in the first place.
And who this child breed with?
Well,
there won't be anybody. I mean, it'll have to be an arranged marriage, no doubt.
It'll have to be something made out of skin cells.
It's kind of left in the air in that respect. How did this infertility, how did it actually come about? We're not really certain in the film. Not that that matters so much, because you sort of carried along by all the activity within the film.
Exactly.
And Julianne Moore appears in the film.
She does, and Sonia, you're going to be talking a little bit more about Julianne Moore later in the show.
Yes. Excellent.
So that was Children of Men and Blade Runner, both great films.
Oh, there's an SMS there. Isn't there?
We've got an SMS. I think we're going to go to a track first, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more. You're on Sci-Fi and Squeam with Sonia and Kaz. Welcome back to Sci-Fi and Squeam. You are listening to Sonia and Kaz, and we are talking about dystopia.
Yes, dystopia. I guess a state where we won't have a future. There is no future. And before that, we had Primal Scream come together. That's going back to the day. And
It is. And we have had somebody SMS in. Thank you, Robert. Mm. Robert from Northcote has said that his future fear, the continued breeding by mentally and physically inferior humans, bring on the replicants.
There we go. Well, that's really... Well, actually, the replicants are, you know, sexier in some films, like Blade Runner, definitely.
Oh, look, they are. They're far more flexible.
Oh, dear. Yeah, they're able to leap tall buildings before it was popular in James Bond movies. So
that's it.
That's cool.
So you kind of get a mix there of Children of Men and Blade Runner.
But will they be able to breed between themselves?
Oh, they don't. I don't think they just grow them.
Oh, right. Reignite them like Moon. Moon. Yep. And now we're going to look at Time of the Wolf. Well, I am anyway. It's a Michael Haneke production, directed and written by him, and came out back in 2003, starring Isabel Huppert and Beatrice Dahl and Patrice Giroux, amongst other people who obviously aren't as well-known. Now, it begins in a quite shocking, unbelievable way, this film. It is set in France. We're not sure exactly where, but it's in the countryside, and that's where it begins. It's a slow and dystopic idea of breakdown. In this case, it's the breakdown of all things of normalcy, which usually happens in these sort of stories. We aren't actually shown the event that brings a woman and her two children, the woman played by Isabelle Huppert. She's a Michael Haneke regular. She's used a lot in his films. But we see that some deep shock of some action has occurred and her two children are seen on a journey. And they're going through the French countryside. I know that they've come from Paris, but what has happened before that and why are they travelling on a stolen bicycle is anyone's business. Mm.
And again, as we've mentioned, it's kind of mysterious. It's not really the event that we need to worry about. It's kind of the unravelling, like you said,
it's
of society afterwards.
Afterwards, you know, which a lot of these newer films that were made in the last 10 years or so have actually departed a lot from that, I guess, the more technical side of things and how these things have come about.
That's
and
it.
And looked at the dirty aftermath of it.
And I think a lot of that possibly with the whole 9/11 thing, because who would have thought one event would have changed?
Exactly. I think it has pushed the pessimism button in a lot of artistic ways, and a lot of directors definitely and writers. So we're seeing these three people on the way to nowhere, basically. They're just travelling down this road and in the countryside in France, and it's empty. Like there's no one around for the first 5 to 8 minutes. There's nothing happening.
And that's very frightening.
It's minimalism to its extent. There's no farm animals. There are no birds singing. There's a budgie, but that's another story. I don't want to spoil that. The little boy has a budgie, her son, and they basically don't talk because of this shocking event that happened previously, a few minutes into the actual film when it started. Now, if there was ever a film that depicts the shock of sudden loss, it'd have to be this one. And director Michael Haneke invites us with our own trepidation into a place and into scenes where there aren't any sort of plot devices that we're used to, or there's not even a narrative connection. There are sudden spurts of violence and there's this ominous presence of something amiss. We're not sure if it was putrid water that's caused some virus to happen, just wiped people out. But there's no trains running. There's no cars that we see on the road. So obviously there's a breakdown, a complete breakdown in society. And the no sounds in nature is very spooky. Eventually what happens is they make their way to a small village and at night, and it's quite biblical, nobody will let them into the house.
No room at the inn.
There's no room at the inn. So they nick a bicycle and they're given some bread, I think, by someone who feels sad for them. Now, these people are middle class, so this is obviously quite a shock for them, because right at the beginning we do see them as being quite well off. And they're from Paris, and a part of Paris that's quite wealthy. Sooner or later they arrive at what seems like an unoccupied railway station house, because we do see a train going past that won't stop. So they get to this station house, and the only people there are people that I think they're Eastern European, but I'm not really sure, and we never find out where they're from, but they do not speak French as their first language. So that's the first hurdle that Anne, as Isabelle Huppert's character is called, that's the first hurdle she has to get over, you know.
Is communicating with the only other people they can find.
Exactly, who don't speak very good French and have a whole family with a crying baby, and it's you know, like they're in a situation that they're really not used to.
Yeah.
And there's no sign of, like I said, cars or other people. And then eventually we see other characters come into play, and there's the intellectual and his wife. There's the family man who seems like quite a good, decent person at the beginning of that part of the film. And there's, you know, children that turn up, and there's a lone Arab boy who speaks a lot of better French than his family. Mm-hmm. He's also there, but he's hiding something. Everybody's sort of hiding something in this film, but you're not really sure what it is.
No, but that, again,
it's so ambiguous.
That's one of those things, though, when you're on your own and you're taken out of everything that you know, you hold things very close to yourself, and you don't see many people in dystopian films or films set in a dystopia where they're opening up to every stranger
they
meet.
They're not opening up. People are holding on to what they have, and they're tired because you're not sleeping. You're not sleeping like you would because you're not comfortable.
You don't feel safe.
You don't feel safe. You don't know where you're going to be sleeping tomorrow. It really is like a war zone. without the action of war, because you don't see people shooting each other. People are just in this limbo area.
Well, you almost get wound back to sort of your primal days where sort of the howl of a wildcat kept you up at night.
Yeah.
Because you just...
But there's no wild animals.
You're working on instinct. Well, there you go. The silence is frightening.
Silence is frightening. And it's really down to who will survive. It will be the mentally strong or the physically strong. Will it be the children or the women or the men? So everyone's drawn the short straw in this film. And I think it's a story of prophecy, actually. It's a time of darkness, uncertainty, deception and hunger, a place where the night is for the wolves, even though there aren't any, and hence the time of the wolves, which I think Haneke's trying to refer there, I think. Now, I won't spoil the total significance of that symbol, the wolf, or fire, which fire does come into the story actually quite strongly. What happens is rumours start to come to the camp. It's now become a camp. It's like
everyone's
a refugee camp.
Together.
Everyone's waiting for the train to come. It's not coming. We don't know if it's coming at all. And why would they be waiting for a train? Because they're not going anywhere. I mean, where are they going to go to? Obviously, everything's broken down.
That's it.
So they're waiting, and while they're waiting, more and more people come along, and the dramas that start to happen there, you know, people stealing from other people, people trading, you know, gold watches for a jug of water because there's a lack of water, there's a lack of meat, there's no fresh milk.
Societies have
no
to,
radio.
No, and they have to reorganize when they're thrown out, when they don't have a law or an authority.
What happens, of course, is the bully becomes, you know, the person that becomes the bully becomes the stronger person. And the person
alpha.
In charge. And it's an alpha male in this situation, or it's a group of alpha males who were local farmers who've obviously taken the upper hand, and now they've got all these city folk that are in a bad way, and they've got them under their spell, basically, or in their power or in control. So, but there is a rumour, as I mentioned just briefly before, there's a rumour that there's some sort of fire worship spreading, a strange relationship with fire, immolation, self-immolation.
Oh, right.
So psychologically, I think people are breaking down, and perhaps he's kind of saying that this is the beginnings of religion, perhaps the beginning of cult, and that's what it seems like. In this film, you know, we're going back to that primal state, which isn't very attractive at all.
No.
Actually. So, yeah, that's The Time of the Wolf, a great film, and if people get a chance to see it. It's not actually based from a book, not taken from a book. It's actually written by Michael Haneke himself, who's an Austrian director by origin, but he works a lot in France and Germany and Spain and so forth.
Excellent. So after these messages, we're going to talk about blindness?
Yeah.
Cool. Fantastic.
You're back with Sci-Fi and Squeam with Sonia and Kaz.
That's right. And we're talking about dystopic visions.
And I must admit, I'm starting to feel depressed.
It is.
It's getting a bit
very
depressing isn't it?
Topic.
Because you start thinking about it.
Oops. Especially, like you said, we're talking today not so much about sort of the dystopic portraits of the past. So we're not really looking at 19th century stuff or the early 20th. We're looking at a lot of things that have been made in the last decade or so.
And there's been quite a lot of significant and very powerful things made and written in this period of time, I think.
There have been, and there have been quite a few things that have occurred in the real world in this period of time that have thrown a lot of people off.
I mean, and September 11 is just
a great example. You sort of go back to
a terrible
September
example,
11.
But a great example.
Well, everyone will say, you know, a lot of people say, I should say, that after the 11th of September 2001, the world changed. It was a different place.
I think they're right.
And whether or not it set us on a track to one of these imaginings, who knows? But you're going to talk to us about blindness.
Blindness, yes. Another one of these dystopic topics, basically. It's based on a José Saramago book, and that came out back earlier in the decade, actually. So that book was it was written in 1995, the film. Was made in 2008, and it stars Julianne Moore, who was in Children of Men, Mark Ruffalo, Gael Garcia Bernal, who's wonderful in that, Danny Glover and Alice Braga. So it's a good mix. It's a Brazilian, Canadian, Japanese production, and the director is a Brazilian director who originally did City of God, and that's probably as close as you can get to real dystopia in modern day Rio de Janeiro.
Exactly.
Have you seen that?
I have seen that.
That's depressing. That's marvelous film, but
it is a great film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the director is Fernando Morales. And Blindness is a film that, to me, meets the requirements as far as the definition of what dystopic stands for and why. It's based on the novel, like I said, from Portuguese Nobel Prize winner José Saramago. And the film version of this book, the whole creation, is a different take from the actual book story itself. We see the start of the film. We see a man wandering in the middle of an intersection, and we're terrified for him because he obviously can't see. He's got out of his car and he suddenly can't, for the life of him, see in front of his face. So he can't drive. So cars are trying to avoid him. There is a man that takes it upon himself to help him into a car to drive him back to his home. And when he's asked, "What do you mean you can't just see?" he says, "Well, it's not like I'm in blackness. It's actually like I am swimming through milk." So instead of the lights being out,
they're just open. So it's like an opaque sort of...
It's like an overexposure of light. And so, but it stays with the person that becomes blind. And, of course, it's contagious. So it starts to spread, and in the film version anyway. So it's not like normal blindness, like I said, with black and nothingness.
Yeah.
So it's quite different. And what it personified for me, I think, is the place or state that these people find themselves in. Firstly, once the contagion spreads like wildfire and people just start, you know, becoming blind within minutes, there's no information from the state itself about what's happening because they obviously don't know.
No word on it.
And basically the whole thing is just shows the lack of support and the mistrust of these infrastructures and the conditions that, you know, arise because of that. These people are left in the lurch, and that's within the first 20 minutes of the film. There's no assistance by government agencies apart from them being put into vehicles and driven to a very run-down hospital complex where they're quarantined off. So society's let them down, and day by day it just gets drawn out longer and longer, and time crawls along just like they do. And literally in some scenes you see people just falling over each other.
Well, they can't see where they're going.
They can't, but they don't have any nurses and they don't have any doctors in these specialised wards, which you see the paint peeling off the walls. They don't even have proper toilet facilities. It's like four toilets to dozens and dozens of people keep turning up. It's very, very bleak. It's just not a feel-good movie at all.
No.
Now, the only person who has sight, and she hasn't let on to anyone, apart from her husband, who's a optometrist, so is Julianne Moore, her character. And all the characters are called by their profession. So right. She's the wife of a doctor, so she's the doctor's wife. So we don't even know what her name is, her real name. She's the doctor's wife. So that's kind of interesting. For example, there's a taxi driver who's the taxi driver and the policeman and so on and so on. That's how people are distinguished from each other.
So, and essentially...
Because they can't see each other.
So. No, and it depersonalises them
in a sense. And then it comes down to the fact that they're numbers. They become numbers, you know, number 7 or number 9, et cetera. You get the idea. So this mysterious virus, we don't know where it comes from. More and more people become afflicted and the wheels of industry and daily routines and systems just break down. So they've been removed and, like I said, they're placed in these wards where she is the only person that can see, and she starts with her husband. Together they start to build some sort of normalcy, some sort of system, because they need to. They feel that they have to do that because they've got the upper hand. She's a sighted person. However, of course, what happens... There's always one bad apple.
Of course.
And that's played by the wonderful Gael Garcia Bernal.
He does bad so very well.
He does it well. Is it because he's a slightly small, diminutive actor?
He is.
Do you think?
He could be. I think he's...
Don't really
he's
notice it.
Very
much.
Attractive. You wouldn't expect him to be a bad character.
No, but that's it. You know, they say Satan was good looking. But anyway, so these poor people are pathetic, and they really are. And after a few days... You start to see excretia everywhere, and people are having sex just randomly, and there's naked people just sitting around because no one can see them except her. Poor Julianne Moore
putting up with all of
the
this.
The doctor's wife. It's pretty bad.
It's funny how quickly humans will reduce sort of to the most base animal.
Yeah, and this is probably only less than a week or something, judging by, you know, what time frame I could make out. So, yeah, the darker aspects of human failings come along, loss of common sense and common decency. Foodstuffs start to be held back because I guess outside it's getting worse, so there's less and less food, and that's where the Gael Garcia Bernal character comes in. He takes control because he's the bad boy.
Of course.
And he's a born leader because he was a barman in his previous life when he had sight. You do see him as a barman or a waiter, so it's quite interesting. He doesn't want to serve people anymore, I guess. So he just takes over one of the wards, and of course what happens? The worst scenes start, things begin to escalate in the film. The submission of women begins for sexual favours in order to acquire food for survival. So we see men in a pathetic state where they're now the blind men who aren't in Gael Garcia Bernal's gang are left in the ward to wait while their women folk are basically raped by this gang in the other ward, Ward 7, I think it is. It's pretty disgusting. And the doctor, who's the Mark Ruffalo character, he's just becomes more and more withdrawn.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. And you sort of said that the humans were pathetic and you sort of pity them. And it's
You pity them at that. You feel, oh, no, of course you would behave like that.
Well, you do. When you sort of look at it and you intellectualise, then that makes sense. But, again, it always amazes me how quickly human beings will sort of reduce to that, you know, their sort of base instinct. But also how you can look at someone who, you know, when they were sighted perhaps within that, you know, that story, and they had a job and they were functioning, and it's a very fine line.
Yes, well, there's a twist in here too. There's a great character actor, veteran, Maury Chalkin.
He's a great actor.
He's awesome. Now, he plays an authentic original blind man. And for some reason, he's in this ward and he's with the Gael Garcia Bernal gang. He's with the bad guys. And the reason why is because he's already got a game ahead of everyone else.
Well, that's it, if he's had experience.
So he's been promised ladies and things like that.
Right. Well, and he could probably teach them a thing or two about how to navigate the world.
So it's pretty disturbing film. And the ending may not be what you want, so this is a bit of a spoiler. It kind of ends on a higher note than probably the last two that we've looked at, where it's suggested that sight begins to return to people.
Right, yeah, because I have read a little bit of this, and I understand that the sightedness is, it's not a permanent affliction.
Yes. Yeah. So whatever you want to make of that, that's fine. But look, I really liked this film. I enjoyed the bleakness, the way the whole blind aspect was handled, and just looking at, yeah, how on earth would a person react in these sort of conditions? I mean, there's a wonderful scene where they're in a supermarket, and of course most of the food by this stage has, you know, the blind people have taken it all, but because she sighted the Julianne Moore character, she manages to find some food that hasn't been touched. And because the blind people have higher senses in the area of their olfactories and smell sense, they can smell that she's got all this food with her. So you see, like zombies, it's very much like a zombie film in some ways. They attack her with all this food that she's trying to carry to her little group because they've escaped the ward. I should have mentioned that earlier.
So people, driven by those essential needs for food and sort of warmth and protection. So that was Blindness, which was a film and a novelized. Oh, it was a novel, and the film was based on the novel.
Yes, that's correct. Yep.
And I think we're going to go to a track now.
Yeah, excellent.
And you're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam. We'll be back after this.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.